HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 85, recorded live Monday, October 15th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Matt Davis, architect at earthclassmail.com.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm sitting here with Matt Davis, the architect at earthclassmail.com. Now, Earthclass Mail was talked about a little bit here on Hansel Minutes when we talked to Tim Ferriss, the author of A 4-Hour Work Week. And he uses it to dramatically lower the amount of information that he has to absorb, the amount of mail he has to touch. So Matt, what is Earthclass Mail?
Basically, it works like kind of like mailboxes, et cetera, for the 21st century. You give us when you sign up with us, we'll give you a virtual PO box and you change your address to us. So we have a number of different processing facilities around the country and different addresses at which you can receive mail. You change your address to one of our addresses, and then any mail that we receive, we scan the envelopes and make them available to you online. So you'd log in just like you would to your Yahoo Mail or your Gmail account, and you see all the external envelope images of any mail that you've received. At that point, you can do one of a few things. You can either ask us to open it and scan it, and we'll, in our secure processing facility, we'll open that up and scan the contents and make them available to you as a PDF. Or you can say, this is junk mail. I don't want it. Just shred it and recycle it, whichever you choose. The other thing you can do is have it shipped to you. You can have it shipped to you without us opening it, or we can open it and scan it and ship you the contents, either way. It makes your mail available to you basically anywhere you are in the world.
So let's say I get 10 snail mails that day, I can go and say shred, 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 and then these 7 mail them to me. You'll batch them up into a big envelope and mail me that whole envelope?
That's correct.
And do you scan front and back so we see the whole thing?
Yep.
Wow. So you could see whatever notes are written on the envelope or whatever.
Yep. Everything that's in the envelope. I mean, they basically have no exceptions policy on there. So, I mean, if you get a piece of junk mail, if you get your publisher's clearinghouse thing and you want to see every little scrap of paper that's in there, we're going to scan it all.
Really? Even like flyers and kind of like Domino's pizza, you know, advertisements and coupons?
Yep. It just makes it simpler if you just say we just scan it all.
I would suspect that you probably shred a heck of a lot of mail.
We do. There is a monster shredding pile over there at the warehouse. Yeah.
And I had this image in my mind of just like robots, like, you know, Honda or Sony robots doing all this work. Is it that, or is it people?
Right now it's people. We've just recently gotten a nice funding block that we're just starting to dip our toe into the waters of automation. And so we've got some really interesting equipment on order that's going to help us get started with mm-hmm. that. And we've got, obviously, if you look at the website, you'll see things about mega sorters, and we've got some prototype robotics designs and things for doing mass, like really mass quantity storage of mail.
Wow. So at some point, it'll probably be faster for the post office just to hand you the mail than to deliver it, you know, through the post office process.
You know, that would be a wonderful day.
That'd be pretty cool. So this sounds like a phenomenally huge amount of data. I mean, along with little tiny bits of data, in the sense of I'm just envisioning there's me and I'm some GUID or some identity in a database somewhere. And then there's unique numbers that identify all of my different pieces of mail. And these are all very small amounts of information. And then there's huge PDFs and images of my mail.
Yep.
So it's just all these little bits of information that point to all this huge amounts of information. You're using SQL Server, or are you using MySQL, or what's your guys' technology?
So the system as it exists as of this recording is running on a LAMP stack. So,
okay, so tell our listeners what LAMP is. Yeah, okay. Not everyone knows that.
Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP.
Okay.
So the system as it stands today was built by a Russian contracting firm, and so it's I don't want to make any comments about quality, but let's say it, you know,
It was built.
The original system was built quickly and
So it's a quickly built LAMP stack.
Yeah.
Based on PHP.
Yeah, and you know it's taken quite a while to get that stable, but it's quite stable as it is, but it doesn't give us a great platform for growth into the future. So
okay,
we are just putting the finishing touches on our .NET port of the system, and actually it's not really even a port; it's a rewrite. It's a complete rewrite with not really a lot of thought to trying to preserve any of the architecture that was there. Basically, the UI looks about the same, and that's it.
Uh-huh. So, now, was the original LAMP stack pretty straightforward? I mean, web browser hits Apache web server. Apache web server writes directly to probably the file system and/or the MySQL database?
Yep, that's correct. And as you can imagine, that presents a number of scalability problems.
And let's talk about that architecture. Are the issues primarily just that it's a straight 3-tier architecture, or it looks like more like a 2-tier architecture?
Yeah, it really is. That's one of the
So you don't have
problems.
An intermediate in anywhere.
That architecture is it's straight. The funny thing is that they did everything in PHP. Like their little back-end daemon processes and things. I mean, there's actually cron jobs that are going running PHP scripts that on the back end. They did everything.
Well,
in
you
PHP.
Know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
That's right.
So is MySQL holding up under the strain, or is that an issue at all?
Actually, the MySQL stuff hasn't been. We haven't had any trouble at all with the MySQL stuff. The real problems that we're having are just memory and mostly, implementation details. I have no doubt that we could have rebuilt this system on LAMP. I don't want to get a bunch of flaming emails from the LAMP lovers. There's no doubt that we could have rebuilt this system on LAMP and been totally fine. But the .NET platform gave us a lot of really interesting new bits that we didn't have to build.
Was that a hard sell? I mean, I assume that there's some boss somewhere above you who has to make those kind of decisions.
Honestly, I don't think it was a hard sell. I actually wasn't even involved in that decision. I was hired on after they decided they wanted to port the new system to .NET. So, mm-hmm. They were looking for a .NET architect that was used to building fairly large systems. So I applied and got the job.
So you're doing this on .NET 2.0 and Visual Studio 2005, or?
Actually, we decided to go ahead and bite the bullet. We're building on Orcus. So.
Really? So you're building on Visual Studio 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean just the IDE, or are you using .NET 3.0 and 3.5?
We're using .NET 3.0 and 3.5. I think the number of standard SQL statements that exist in this piece of software is probably could be counted on one hand. The entire thing is powered by Link to SQL. All the data tier is powered by Link to SQL. We're using WCF to communicate between the tiers. All the operations software is written in WinForms and WPF.
Really? So, WPF? Are you doing click once?
Actually, unfortunately, we have some real problems with click once because we have to do a little bit of native code interop to talk to scanners and things like that.
Oh, right.
So click once doesn't play. You can make it work, but the other problem with click once that we had is you can't deploy multiple. You can't deploy to a machine. You deploy to a user. So operator workstations are kiosks. So, we may have a number of different operators sitting at a given station in a given day. And so each one of them has their own Active Directory login which means they'd have multiple copies of the software. And given that we have some queuing software and stuff that's running in the background as well as a Windows service, it didn't play too well with click once as it stands today, unfortunately.
Wow. So there's a lot going on here. I'm trying to think what we should talk about first. So let's start at the back end and work our way up to the monitor.
Okay.
So, Link to SQL. So you really kind of jumped in both feet. And was that a hard sell? I mean, I'm sure, cause sometimes there's shops that are very database focused and they really think that Sprox are where it's at, right? And the logic is in the Sprox. And, Link to SQL is really a powerful technology, but I wouldn't say it's Sprox friendly.
Yeah. I might almost disagree that it's not Sprox friendly. You can make it work with Sprox, but obviously the real power and sexiness of Link to SQL is being able to do everything right there in the code. I thought it might be a hard sell initially. My boss, the VP of engineering here he's an old school database head. And so I was figuring that I was going to get some pushback on that, but, really, he just said, do whatever he thinks right. And so
that's cool.
Initially, I was a little nervous about it and I had all the Link to SQL stuff locked away in a class that, I didn't let anything leak out of that class. So if Link to SQL just completely fell down on me, that I could go back and fix it. But, it's been working fantastic. I mean, we found a couple of bugs here and there, and we had some pain going from beta 1 to beta 2. They changed the null semantics on us and did a few other things. But in general, it's worked out fantastic.
Okay, so let's talk about it from a design perspective. So you've got a bunch of leaked to SQL statements. You said that they're working okay with Sprock. So there are some Sprocks that you call.
I mean, actually not. We've linked in a couple of SQL Server functions so that we can use them directly from the linked to SQL stuff. But no, actually we have zero stored procedures. We have like two triggers. I mean, this is pretty much a code centric application, which makes the deployment update really
so
nice.
So you were saying just a second ago that, and I need to be educated about this. So it's friendly. Not, you said it's friendly, linked to SQL is friendly to Sprocks, but you said also to, you had some SQL Server functions that you linked in. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Basically, like, you have to hack, right now it's not a very good story. You have to actually hack the DBML files yourself. So the OR designer doesn't allow you to drag in system functions, or at least I haven't figured out how to get it to work. You know, there might be some trick, but I'm not a big user of the Server Explorer, so I don't know all the different modes that are there.
Sure.
But, in general, as far as linked to SQL is concerned, a system function or a system sprock looks the same as one of yours. You just, it's just a matter of how you address it in the DBML. So, normally, like if you have user defined functions and things like, and user defined sprocks, you just drag those in out of Server Explorer onto the OR designer surface and they just magically appear as methods on your data context and you can call them from anywhere you're using that linked to SQL data context.
I'm going to have to educate myself about that. Okay. So you said you had this stuff locked away in a class. So you've got a bunch of stuff in a class. And it's using link to talk to the database.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the right hand. What's going out the left hand? What kind of objects are you returning out of there?
So this is one of the other things that was really sexy about link to SQL. The interop story between link to SQL and so we're using WCF. The left hand is WCF.
What used to be called Indigo.
Yeah. And I loved Indigo.
I
still die inside a little bit when I call it WCF.
It's kind of sad.
But so I was glad they left Silverlight as Silverlight.
Well, at least Link isn't called WDF or something.
Yeah. Link is actually kind of a sexy name. So
it's the
Q. It works. It is the Q. You're right. It's all about the Q. So anyway, yes, the left-hand side is WCF. So the interop story between link to SQL and WCF is a little scary because I'm personally not one that I don't like to let my message contracts and my data contracts look too much like my database. I like them to look like the logical, more logical.
So you like to separate your data transfer objects and your business objects.
Yes.
But with a DBML file, you point your database at it and then kind of public class foo shows up if you've got a foo table, unless you decide to hack that up. And then you can kind of get to where I was going. Do you let those objects out?
Yeah.
Or do you make other ones that look like them?
I screwed around for about 2 weeks trying to figure out a decent way to let those objects out or to decorate those objects in such a way that I could control what they looked like. Mm-hmm. And actually,
what they look like on the wire or from the CLR perspective?
Yeah, no, both, but more what they look like on the wire.
Okay. So you're talking about putting data contract, and basically WCF attributes, decorating them on the generated.
Correct. Or trying to do it on the, in a partial class on the side, or trying to do it on a base class. I mean, I messed around with it for quite a while trying to come up with a combination that worked.
Mm-hmm.
And actually they changed the story between beta 1 and beta 2. Beta 1, you could apply in the OR designer, you could actually apply any attributes you wanted to any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They backed off on that. And now basically there's one bit there's no custom attribute support in the OR designer. There's basically a bit you can flip on any class that says, serializable or not. And if you mark it serializable, it adds the data contract and data member attributes to everything. It's all or nothing.
So the serializable bit that you're talking about is almost like a make this WCF friendly or not, but not the granularity that you wanted.
Right. So what we ended up doing actually is building some just really simple copy methods that will copy from a given link type, you know, do a deep copy of a given link type into a given WCF contract type. So we actually have, completely separate WCF contract types defined. And then there are places where, and the really cool thing about link to SQL was that you can actually plug that in your select statement. So in the select call on the link, on the link query, we actually call that copy method. So instead of like getting back a bunch of objects and then for eaching over them and making copies of the WCF objects, it actually comes
doing
straight
a big
out
formal
of
formal marshalling.
Yeah. It actually comes right out. We squirt the WCF bits right out the back of link.
So then what's the point of the link types at all?
So the link types still, the link types still have to abstract. I mean, ultimately, at some level, you have to have something that, that looks like what's in the DB.
I see.
So with link to SQL, you know, and I know with Entity Framework and some of the other things that are coming out, this is, the story's a little different. And I, you know, Entity Framework is interesting to me. I wonder if it wouldn't solve some of the problems, but I just don't have the bandwidth to look into it since it's not shipping in a time frame that works for us. So mm-hmm. I'll definitely be looking into it when it comes back. But, anyway, yeah, link to SQL, you ultimately have to have a class somewhere that looks like what's in the DB so that that, that OR mapper can do its job.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the easiest way to get that is to use the OR designer, which is the, you know, just the GUI drag and drop tables out of SQL Server. And
so this deep copy, is this a reflection thing?
No, it's just straight, you know, stupid, you know, this field maps to this field, copy.
Is it manually written?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm just brainstorming here. I'm trying to challenge my own assumptions as well as yours. So you wanted so much control over the WCF types that you did that left-hand, right-hand kind of, you know, this field, that field, this field, mm-hmm. that field work, as well as having a whole separate kind of identity. What was wrong with just the push a button and it's available to WCF serialize property?
Well, given that some of the growth changes that we know we're going to be going through, I think trying to keep them isolated a little bit. What we did is we designed the WCF types to look like, you know, to be a little more forward looking in the way to have a few features in there that aren't turned on yet. And then we have things that aren't even in the DB yet, or we have things that we made shortcuts in the DB to, you know, we sacrificed some normalization to get something where, if we tried to expose that directly through the contracts types, you'd end mm-hmm. up with something that's kind of unwieldy. It actually works really well when you're talking to it through link because you have some fairly decent control over, the, you know, back references and things that make them a little more queryable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fantastically easy to do joins and things like that. I mean, I look at the SQL that I would have had to write, you know, something that I can write in, you know, a fairly short line of a link mm-hmm. to SQL query. I mean, it might be, you know, it'd be, you know, 30 or 40 lines of nasty SQL to put it together, and it wow. generates it for me. And every once in a while, you can watch the queries that come out.
Right.
Every once in a while, with the
visualizer.
Mm-hmm. Well, even without the visualizer, you can sort of see it. And that, you know, I know Scott Goo put out that ASP.NET or the link to SQL query visualizer, and that thing is just fantastic.
Yeah. Have you used LinkPad?
I haven't. I've seen it.
Got to check that out.
Yeah.
It lets you, it's basically a query analyzer. It lets you write link and then see what comes out. So it's a query analyzer like experience where you type link F5, type link F5. So you basically get your queries right inside of LinkPad and then copy paste them over into Visual Studio.
And I'm assuming that's targeting link to objects, not link to SQL.
No, link to SQL, link to objects, link to whatever.
Huh, interesting.
It's a totally generic thing. Yeah,
I'd be interested to see how they're doing the class mapping stuff for the link. I mean,
it'd be interesting to see if your stuff works, the stuff that you're doing where the objects actually pop out the side.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about validation? Because one of the things that I thought was cool about link is the idea that I could have like public partial class product, and that's inside of the designer, and that's generated. And the way that they get around not being able to edit that generated code, as well as avoiding kind of uncomfortable object hierarchies for things like validation, being able to like they could have called it product base and then you derive and have an on validate and then things like that, on insert and stuff like that. You can have partial methods, right? So you could have public partial method on validate. And mm-hmm. that's the method that gets called when it's time to validate a particular class.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done that kind of stuff at all?
We've played with the partial method stuff a little bit. Unfortunately, we did most of our design on the beta 1 stuff where the partial methods bits weren't in there yet. So we've, you know, since switching to beta 2, we've plugged in a few things there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that stuff was baked, unfortunately, it was baked after we had baked our code. So, mm-hmm. The partial method stuff is really interesting though, because it is basically just like lightweight eventing. I mean, it's really cool that the compiler doesn't generate anything if, you know, you only pay the price for that eventing overhead if you actually do something with the event, if you implement a handler for it. So.
Yeah, it's taken me a while to get my brain around it because, you know, if you think about how I've got this class and I say, you know, data context submit all changes. And if that class isn't cool, I want to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And how could that have been done? It could have been done with a pub sub. It could have been formally eventing .NET events.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been derivation with a virtual method that gets called if it's overridden, or with the partial classes where the partial methods rather, where if the method is implemented, it'll get called. How are you keeping track of validation? How do you prevent a foo object from getting into the database if it's not really correct?
We have several layers of validation going on. I mean, obviously the first stuff is happening up in the UI and in the front end of the service tier. Just doing, you know, standard old school validation, so, you know, ASP.NET validation things on the front end and just normal checks on the back end.
Input then, validation controls.
Yeah. Just basic stuff. Further back, you know, we've got a lot of checks in the DB itself to that are doing some consistency checking. There are a few triggers that run looking for goofy things that we couldn't catch in easier ways, but, yeah, for the most part, basically we do the checking as the objects are being created, because usually since there is that left to right, you know, where we're converting from a WCF type to a link type, sometimes we'll do the checking in there too. But, one of the problems that we have with the validation, I mean, obviously you usually have to, when you split the things across tiers that way, you usually have to do the majority of the validation up front. So that, you know, we don't want to have to go all the way back to the DB tier to find out that something's wrong and then have to marshal some kind of an exception that's understandable to ASP.NET all the way back up.
Right.
So the, you know, the stuff that's going on in the service tier is mainly like the kind of the backstop for things that, you know, didn't get through or were maliciously stuffed in, you know, through an Ajax endpoint or something that bypassed.
Okay. So ASP.NET, makes some object that's, makes a service proxy, I assume, makes a WCF service proxy, makes a foo object that is a WCF object, and then passes it into WCF. What do those methods look like and how do they map all the way back?
Well, so, that's one of the places where we've kind of gone away from the Microsoft guidance a little bit and we're taking advantage of some of the flexibility of WCF. So, I'm definitely more of a contract first kind of developer. I like the idea of, you know, defining my wire format to an extent. I mean, I'm not quite as into it as Tim Ewald or whatever.
Sure. But you like your control. You want your angle brackets a certain way.
I do. We're actually in almost all the literature that I've seen describing WCF, everybody kind of downplays the message contract. So, the message contract is the thing that basically, you know, maps to like a WSDL operation.
Which is funny because it seemed to me like a couple of years ago it was all about contract first.
Yes.
And then it switched to code first. And, I think I'm with you. I'm still back in the contract first world.
Well, the thing that bothers me the most about the, you know, if you skip message contracts in Indigo and WCF, you end up with, you know, everything is a method call, right? So if I need to add a field, well, I just screwed myself because now, you know, the next time I regen my client, all of the other stuff is going to break. I don't have as much control. If you do something really screwy where you like change the type of a parameter, or, you know, if you leave something, you can get some really subtle, interesting, hard to debug issues. So, I don't know. I'm more a fan of the message contract programming. So basically all of our contracts are defined in terms of, you know, all the operations are defined in terms of message contracts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so ASP.NET guy makes a service proxy, passes some stuff into WCF. So do you have actual physical tiers? Because sometimes I think that there's a bit of confusion when people use tiers versus layers.
Mm-hmm.
I think of layers as logical things and tiers as physical things. So there's a physical separate box from the ASP.NET box that handles that all the WCF hosting?
Yes, in a deployment scenario, that's true. I mean, in development, obviously, we're not messing around with that. So the tiers are both logical and physical. In deployment, they are set up for physical separation. So, for instance, the stack that we have, the stack that we're going live with on our .NET system is 8 servers. So, so there are 2 web servers, 2 app servers that handle things like, you know, billing, email alerts, all the little just eventing stuff. And then we have these 2 large image servers that store all of so they have a 2 terabyte file store on them each that store all of the, you know, all the images and PDFs and all that stuff. And actually those also do the, those are also running a WCF Ajax service, which is new for 3.5. So we're self-hosting a WCF Ajax service in there that, the browser. So we're doing, if you look at the client, the way the client works, when it requests all the metadata about mail. So when you're doing your, you know, you look at all your envelope images and all that stuff, it's making an Ajax request. It's all client side. It's making an Ajax request directly back to that image store. The image store is handling, you know, all the marshalling. That's where all the link to SQL stuff that's going on for mail, mail metadata.
So how do I keep that from, how do I, like, as a, I'm an evil guy and I want to sniff that Ajax and I want to go and try to look for other people's mail.
Well, go ahead. Give it a shot. It's probably not going to work.
And yeah, so how do you handle that kind of authorization? I mean, is it all based on cookies and that forms authentication ticket is kind of fundamental?
Well, actually, the problem there is, so we weren't able to use any of that stuff because trying to host forms authentication outside ASP.NET is kind of tricky. I mean, you can do it, but we didn't want to turn. So, like I said, we're self-hosting the WCF Ajax services over there. So the things that are running on the image servers, there's no IIS or, you know, there's no
web server. You're self-hosting. You're saying like there's like a console or a Windows service.
Yes, there's a Windows service that actually hosts the WCF, the new web HTTP binding. Hmm. So it's super fast, super lightweight. Right. It's really nice not having IIS in the mix, but you know, you're kind of out in the lone dreary world there because you don't have the stuff that comes in the ASP.NET pipeline that you get so used to. You know, you don't get your cookies, you don't get your caching, you don't get, you basically, you know, they give you a headers collection and you can stuff whatever you want, look whatever you want, but that's it.
Like, here, good luck with that.
Yeah. There's no built-in cookie handling. There's no nothing there. So.
Have you thought about using, Vista and Windows Activation Service?
Yeah, actually, I wish we had built our dev machines.
It's kind of screaming for it, you know, for that particular instance.
Right. As it is right now, we don't use Windows Activation Service. So there is there's a console app, like when the developers are working with something, there's a console app that hosts all the other individual services.
I see.
And then we just have a few config entries that point everything to the right place. But, you know, one of the other really big problems that we ran into there was that, Ajax, it's kind of a loosely documented, the behavior of Ajax when it comes to multiple hosts is kind of loosely documented. So everybody talks about cross domain. You can't do cross domain. Well, it turns out you also can't do cross host, which is different than everything else. Like the, you know, if you want to serve images or anything from a browser, like a browser can like through an SSL connection or not, it doesn't matter where you can request from different hosts on the same domain and that works fine. Ajax doesn't work that way. And I found that out the hard way.
Okay, so what do you mean? Can you give me some examples? And like, you're talking about like www1.
Well, sure. So for instance, I mean, I told you that our image and mail metadata servers are running on separate physical hardware.
Right.
So the original intent was that those things would just be a separate host. You know, it'd be, you know, ajax.earthclassmail.com and, and you would make a request to that. Well,
separate subdomain within the larger domain.
Right. It's just separate hosts. I mean, it shows up as a separate virtual IP because everything's all in an active stack. So,
right.
So, you know, we just have however many boxes we need. We've got a load balancer sitting out front that's just doing stupid load balance, you know, just
round robin.
Yeah. And, everything's hunky dory, except that, you can't do that with Ajax.
Like, so it has to go back exactly to where it came from.
Yep. It has to go
back.
That's
why people talk about having Ajax proxies, basically. Services that do nothing but proxy Ajax traffic.
Yep. And this was my first real experience with Ajax. I kind of poked at it and played with it a little bit before, but, I'd never had to deal with it on any kind of a scale that where I would need to do something across multiple hosts. So we ended up having to do some magic on our load balancer, some layer 7 content redirection to say, okay, anything that says /JSON goes to that server. And, you
know, the other way would have been to have the ASP.NET servers that the page was served from basically host a proxy that did nothing but left hand, right hand, which would have been more of a hassle than
Well, and it's just a waste of bit. Why would I why channel the bits through the ASP.NET server?
Right, when the load balancer can do it.
Yeah.
So back to the security thing. So you don't have cookies. You don't have a lot of automatic stuff going on. What's, you know, how do you get the image server to not give back images that the user shouldn't be allowed to see?
So basically what we ended up having to do is roll a little bit of our own sessioning infrastructure that goes against the DB. So one of the nice things is that we don't have security below the mailbox level. So if you're a business account or if you have multiple people in your household, you can, you know, your Scott Hanselman mailbox, you can grant access to your mailbox to someone else to be able to snoop around and see your mail. Like, you know, if you're in a business and you have a secretary that you want to be able to see your mail, or whatever, you want to delegate the handling of your mail to someone else in your family while you go on vacation or whatever, you can do that. There's no security below the mailbox level. So the way all that stuff gets stored, what we can do is basically we can grant you a little token that says, all right, you know, this is Scott's session, and back in the DB, we can know that Scott's session is associated to, we know what mailboxes you have access to, and we just do an access check. Whenever you make a request, I mean, you still have a cookie that came through, but it's a cookie that we assigned to you that, you know, so we're not using ASP.NET sessions or anything like that to do this. We basically kind of had to roll our own sessioning.
So the request comes in for the picture of my, my Domino's pizza coupon that was sent to me. We go to the database to make sure that this is me. The ticket that I came in with is Scott's ticket. Scott's mail are these things. Is this file that just got requested part of Scott's mail?
Yeah.
That's, so somebody goes and tries to ask for a different, a different unique ID and tries to sneak a look at someone else's mail. It's not part of his mailbox. He can't see it.
Right. They're all mailbox qualified. So, we ended up doing is storing things. So there's actually not a DB hit involved in any of that except for the initial access check on the mailbox, which we cache. So basically, you know, you're always coming to us. You're always going to be coming back to us probably asking for mail from Scott's mailbox. I mean, except in some really strange administrator scenarios where we allow like an administrator to have access to multiple mailboxes.
Or if I'm
like,
evil.
Yeah. Well, even if you're evil, like, well, we're going to tell you to go away if you come and ask for an image that isn't in your mailbox. So, but the way those things are stored on the file system, we know what mailbox they're stored in. There's some pointer files and things that are going on the file system so that we don't actually have to hit the DB for every one of those hits. So it's, our image servers are really nice.
That's
and fast
nice.
On
that
their
way
system.
Someone can't kind of cause a denial of service by virtue of the fact that you're just an evil person asking for a lot of mail that's not his. Doesn't affect the database.
Correct, because we also cache the negative. So
nice.
Yeah, if you come to us and try to hit some other mailbox, we're gonna say no, and
yeah,
we also usually that gets logged as well. So,
oh yeah, right, because of course it's auditing, right? Because this is about your mail.
Yes,
very cool. And then just real briefly, you were talking about doing WPF on the client side. So when people hear WPF, they think in a kind of transparency and animation and all sorts of stuff. Are these pretty sexy looking applications for managing mail on the front end, or WPF and not just WinForm?
They're a lot sexier than their WinForms counterparts, but there's actually there's a fair amount of data binding, and obviously we're dealing with a little bit of image manipulation here, so some of those things are a little easier to do in WPF with the stuff that comes in the box.
Okay,
it's a lot easier to scale an image and get it to work the way you want, and there's we haven't actually deployed that software yet either. We've done a couple of prototypes and test deployments of it, but the look and feel definitely went over well with the folks over in the warehouse that are running it. So
that's interesting. A lot of people think about the pretty stuff, but the first thing you said was the data binding. That's kind of like one of the cool things about WPF that I read in Chris Sell's book.
Deep data binding is the way of the future.
Is it really?
Oh man. Binding path. It's all about binding path.
Is it all about binding path?
Cause you can dot as far into an object as you want for data binding. And you try to do that in WinForms and it's kind of a pain.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds like you're breaking the law of Demeter at that point. If you can go 3-4 deep into an object.
Well, we don't usually go that far, but
yeah,
but
cool. Well, Matt, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here on Hansel Minutes. And, maybe we'll come by sometime with a video camera and we'll do some actual demos, maybe do as kind of a screencast or something and look at some of the cool stuff that you're doing. And so you can go live with Beta 2 if you wanted to, right? You've got the go live license.
That's actually our plan. We'll even if the 2008 RTMs before we actually hit it, just because we've done all our testing in Beta 2, we'll probably end up deploying on Beta 2 and then do a quick release, within a few weeks after we've actually had a chance to, figure out what changed between Beta 2 and RTM. But
cool.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
All right. We'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes.